National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
In a new pastoral letter, the Archbishop of Los Angeles says it's urgent for every Christian to embrace the adventure of holiness in the face of a de-Christianizing culture. We talk with Register correspondent Peter Jesser Smith about Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez's guidance on the Christian walk. And then we have a conversation with Register senior editor Joan Desmond about her recent article on the science of conversion therapy and gender ideology, plus a remarkable and surprising new documentary on Flannery O'Connor. It's all coming up on Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. I'm joined by my co-host, Register senior editor Matthew Bunsen.
Great to be with you, as always.
And here in the studio, we have Peter Jesser Smith. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jeanette. Always a pleasure.
Now, we've got this new pastoral letter, which pastoral letters for archbishops and bishops is pretty common. But what's unique about this one?
Well, I think what really is unique is that Archbishop Jose Gomez has really, he's identified really an urgency for our times, which is that every Christian man and woman must rediscover the call of greatness that is the Christian faith and what God has destined them to be. I can only say that this is a resounding call of heroism and adventure. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, my father is a great study of Winston Churchill, but he mentioned how Churchill could inspire every man, woman, and child in England that they were like King Arthur and following in their ancestors' footsteps. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, this is what Archbishop Gomez has done with this letter, is make me, and I think many Christians feel like, yes, we can become saints no matter how humble our station or where we are. This is our call to greatness, and now is the time.
You know, now is the time, but now is a difficult time. You know, I mean, we look around and you can think of all the things that pastoral letters could be written on in our culture. I mean, we're up next, we have a conversation about gender ideology and transgenderism and mm-hmm. all of that. I mean, there's so much that we could write about. He has chosen to write about something uplifting.
Absolutely. But I think it's because it's in difficult times that the call to heroism becomes all the more clearer. Mm-hmm. And he's identified that, I think over the course of this election cycle, we saw many, many things that have been brewing for a long time become unleashed in our society. And I think everyone can agree, no matter where they fall on the political spectrum, that we're still feeling that. There's a miasma in the air. And I think what he's saying is that, you know, he said that the elites, the media, so many forces in the culture have just been shredding the Christian vision for life, mm-hmm. and has been deepening secularism and driving out God with this anti-humanistic spirit. And what's happened as a result of that is when God is driven out, so is the dignity of the human person and the mm-hmm. dignity of the family, and we're seeing it on multiple levels. The only antidote is if every man, woman, and child realizes that the response to this is to embrace what the saints have said is our royal heritage and our destiny, and become saints, truly follow Jesus Christ, and embrace that call to holiness, which is fundamentally a call to love. We don't talk about sin very much, but Archbishop Gomez did, and he made a mm-hmm. brilliant point. Sin is disordered love, but holiness is a call to love purely and simply as God does, and as God loves all of us. I think that's a great dynamic and a great way to introduce to this culture this notion of what sin is and what holiness is and why it's attainable.
Well, Peter, I love the use of the term adventure to describe the lives of the saints and the progress to holiness.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's really the thing, is that it is an adventure. It is exciting. This is the epic for which God has destined all of us. It's that which the saints lived, even in the most humble of circumstances. I think of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, who lived such a rich life within the four walls of her convent. But that's because life in God opens up so many different possibilities, because God is limitless. But it's sin and living life away from God that makes us smaller and meaner and really closes in the walls of our universe around us. And that's the beautiful thing Archbishop Gomez has done, is just illustrate this beautiful portrait of what the possibilities are and that they're attainable for all of us.
And it's perfect timing. I mean, it's right here at the start of Lent.
Absolutely.
What are some of the things that you, I mean, I'm here in a studio with you. It's so awesome. I get to see your passion, Peter. What are some of the things that you do during this great adventure of Lent? I mean, Lent's an adventure as well.
Well, one of the things I've been doing, and I think Archbishop Gomez has outlined a beautiful practical plan for every Christian to adopt. You know, he talks about saying morning and evening prayer, placing yourself in the presence of God each day. I'm a member of the personal ordinariate of the Chair of St. Peter, and has a beautiful English tradition of saying morning and evening prayer, and that's something that I've really taken to heart and been practicing more. But he says, make time every day for prayer. Read a passage of the Gospels every day. He talks about using this technique of Lectio Divina, and I'm trying to engage more with that. I think one of the things that, a couple other things that he also talks about is meeting Christ. Meeting Jesus Christ as often as you can in the Eucharist, mm-hmm. both through adoration and going to Mass during weekdays. And in this letter, he says, when we meet Christ in the Eucharist, it helps us meet Christ in other people, especially the poor, the weak, and the vulnerable. They're both connected. If we can't meet Christ in them, we can't meet Christ in the Eucharist. And I'm working this Lent on doing a daily examination of conscience. I thought, that's a good idea. Go to confession regularly. Try to find opportunities to practice corporal spiritual works of mercy. Mm-hmm. This is one I really, really want to work on. When I was living in D.C., I found this actually a lot easier because when I was traveling to work, this is actually one of the consolations that I really enjoyed, which was there are so many poor and homeless people, and a lot of them just are walked by every day, and nobody talks to them, or people just hand out some money and walk on.
Right.
But Pope Francis had an interesting idea, which I took to heart, which was, make a conversation with them. Share your name. Shake their hand. Ask what their name is. And I discovered that Jesus Christ is in every person like that, and he saves us through those moments, through those conversations, through recognizing the human dignity of the person in front of us. So that's what I'm working on.
And you could bring that right back to Archbishop Gomez's pastoral letter, because he talks about finding Jesus in the other person.
Yes.
And that at one line he says, true friendship is spiritual friendship. And so the idea is that through our friendships, we can draw others to Christ and to the fullness of truth. And that can happen in any kind of true friendship, where mm-hmm. we listen, where we hear the joys and the concerns of another person, and we walk with them, and we try to invite them into the beauty of faith.
Yes, and I think that's one of the insights he had in this letter, too, which was we need to rediscover the authentic meaning of friendship, that mm-hmm. the true intimacy that's possible between persons, either the same sex or the opposite sex. I mean, this beautiful quote from St. Basil and Gregory of Nazianzen, where St. Gregory says, it seemed as if we had one soul in two bodies. That's just something so beautiful that I think in our social media age, we tend to lose sight of. But and he said it's important for marriage. We need to foster an intimate friendship in marriage. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever kind of heard people say this, but I consider my wife my best friend. But I remember going through college and encountering people who said, well, I can't date them because she's my best friend. Like, don't you realize what's most important at the end of the day?
Who do you want to marry?
Yeah, exactly.
Or people break up because it's just a friendship. And you're like, wait a minute, this is strange.
It is strange. Yeah. And that's why I think it's important. This letter is so beautiful, and it's a roadmap for living Christian greatness, no matter how humble our lives are in the day-to-day. I think this is brilliant. It's what we need at this time.
The greatest adventures are timeless.
Yes.
And one of the things that's striking about this pastoral letter is that he builds on this foundation of eternal truths,
mm-hmm.
but also how he grounds it in pulling up these examples, some of the ones that you've just given.
Yes.
So what is it about this pastoral letter that you find so remarkable in the way that he crafts the narrative?
As a writer.
Yes. I think he crafts it as a meditation or a reflection, but a reflection born one of deep personal experience.
There's an intimacy to this thing, isn't
there? There's an intimacy, yes, but there's also an intimacy with the saints that you can tell they're very close to him, and so close is he to Our Lady, the Blessed Mother. He says, be close to them. Mm-hmm. They are revealing the greatness. They knew it. They experienced it intimately. And they said, this is possible for every one of you. Don't be afraid. Embrace it. And it's so it crescendos into this feeling that I can be a saint too. Just like, you know, Churchill could make men and women in England at their darkest hour feel like they were King Arthur in the footsteps of their ancestors. This is what Gomez does at the time when the dark clouds of our culture have really started to gather.
Well, there's that quote attributed to Augustine that you tell me that the times are evil will become holier and the times will get better.
Yes.
You are the times.
Yes, these are our times, and this is our time for greatness.
But holiness is even more relevant today than it was in the time of Augustine.
Well, it was bad in Augustine's time as well, but I think God has all made us for our own times. And he made Augustine in his times, but the timeless truths of God ring out through the ages. And we have this great patrimony of saints and this great treasury that has all been prepared for us in our time. And if they say this is the time of the laity, this is the time where the laity now have all these riches and support of the saints and the Blessed Mother. We need to go into action and do it, because that's what our world needs right now.
One of the things about the pastoral letter, thinking of its author, who is Archbishop Gomez of Los Angeles, the name of the pastoral letter, by the way, I don't know that we've said it. It's called For Greater Things You Were Born. That's Archbishop Gomez of Los Angeles, his pastoral letter. And I think of Archbishop Gomez, who I got to know a little bit in Denver when he was there. He was auxiliary bishop, and I lived in Denver. And so I got to know him. He is a quiet person when you speak to him. He's very kind of, he speaks in an underbreath, you know, kind of way. And I could imagine him saying all of this to me if I were talking to him. That's mm-hmm. how intimate it is, Matthew, as you referenced earlier. It's almost understated, but it's a great mission. It's worth reading. It's a good Lenten read, so we encourage our listeners to go ahead and pick it up and read this. If you want a sort of snapshot of it, you can read Peter Jesser Smith's piece at ncregister.com, and the piece is titled Archbishop Gomez, We Must Become Saints for Our Times. Peter's here with us in studio. We've been so grateful to speak with you face-to-face. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeanette and Matthew.
And when we come back, we'll talk with Register Senior Editor Joan Desmond on her recent article about transgender theory, and as well on a new documentary on Flannery O'Connor, which I look forward to that conversation. This is Register Radio, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we come back.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Listener. Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, with Register Senior Editor Matthew Bunsen. We are joined now by Senior Editor Joan Desmond.
Hi, Joan. Jeanette.
It's great to have you in studio.
Great to be here.
Joan, you know, Peter just got to talk about this adventure of holiness, an adventure in a time of our culture that is quite complex, quite challenging. He kind of had this great energy about the path of holiness. We have to talk about something right now that is very challenging in our culture, and that is this whole concept of transgenderism. There's gender ideologies that are kind of poking their head into a lot of areas of our culture, of our life. And one is in a story that you recently wrote about some decisions that were made on conversion therapy. The story had a great title, and we're going to break this title down as we continue this conversation. The title was, "Does Science Support Bans on Conversion Therapy for Gender Identity Issues?" It's a great question that we're going to dissect. What prompted this article?
Well, what we're discovering is that we have legislation now. We have ordinances in localities like Toledo, Ohio. So Toledo, Ohio just approved a ban on so-called conversion therapy for same-sex attraction and also for gender identity issues, people who believe that they are in the wrong body, that mm-hmm. their birth certificate says they're a male, they feel they're female. The problem is that this has some political dimensions to it. Mm-hmm. This has legal dimensions to it. Schools, as you may know, are dealing with so-called bathroom rules, where those who believe that they identify more with the opposite sex from their biological sex want to go to the bathroom that they want to go to. It's all coming to a head right now, even more right. So because we have a Supreme Court case coming up. So let's backtrack for a minute on this and say, what did Toledo, Ohio try to do?
Right.
What they tried to do was to ban, not just for minors, for all adults who say to themselves, I feel like I want to be in the body of the opposite sex. I don't want that. I want to get help.
I don't want this feeling.
I don't want this feeling. I want to get help. They basically have banned that for everyone, not
getting
just
the help.
Yes.
Right.
Getting the help, getting the therapeutic help. And one thing I learned in this whole story, it's a complex story, is that there are three different strategies for dealing with this. For quite a while, therapists have been concerned with helping people deal with this by either strongly encouraging them to re-identify, to clarify their true gender, and to start acting on that and to try to overcome these unwanted mm-hmm. feelings that they may have. A second approach is just to say, well, let's just go along, but let's not try to act on this. So sort of a neutral position.
Okay.
And the third is an affirmative position, and this is where the bathroom wars come in. You go ahead, take the pronoun that you feel most comfortable with, dress the way you want to dress, and go to the bathroom you want to dress in. So some therapists have saying this is the way to go. And then schools are told you have to adapt to this, or this person is not only going to be uncomfortable, but in mm-hmm. some cases could actually have very serious mental health problems that could get worse. So schools don't know what to do. And now localities like Toledo, Ohio, already five or six states have already banned conversion therapy, either for same-sex attraction, but also for transgender identity issues. So this is the backdrop we're dealing with.
And for a lot of people who are wondering, we're really talking about a tiny, tiny percentage of the population, aren't we?
Correct. It's like 0.05%.
Wow.
Yeah. And yet it's literally affecting every school district in the country.
Now, one of the interesting things about the Toledo case, for example, the judge, I believe, ruled that science is settled on this. Is it?
Well, Toledo, it was just a local ordinance.
Okay.
And yes, the local legislator, you know, the council person there
okay.
locally said, well, the science is settled. And no, not only is the science not settled. I think what's confusing for the public and perhaps confusing for this council member is that the media suggests the silence is settled, right, and the activists are suggesting the science is settled. But actually, there's a very robust debate going off online. And the problem is it's become so politicized. A lot of the experts in medicine and elsewhere who disagree are basically doing so offline.
You know, what's really interesting about that is in your article, some of the sources, they're not all Catholic sources that are saying, no, the science isn't settled. I mean, one of the sources is the American College of Pediatricians that's saying, no, this isn't settled. So I think it's important to know that it's not just Catholics who are saying, you know, raising the red flag and saying, wait a minute, we really do need to look at the science. It's there are other people who are trying to bring that voice up as well.
Well, I think what's really tragic, Jeanette, is, I mean, if you take a parallel case, I mean, there are differences but similarities. If my daughter had anorexia but thought she was fat, mm-hmm, would I want someone to say, fine, keep losing weight, mm-hmm, you know, and potentially threaten her health as a result? I think there are similarities, there's differences to these issues, but the similarity is you have a situation where someone perceives something to be one way very strongly, and the question is, should that be challenged or supported?
Right.
Or just dealt with neutrally. And the neutral thing is important, Jeanette, because one point I want to make that the scientists and experts in the field make is, in most cases, gender identity confusion is a short-term fluid situation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't last. So do you want to encourage something? Do you want to help the person clarify their gender that corresponds and aligns with their biology? Or if you want to encourage a misalignment, there's another problem related to this, because there's high level of mental health problems that are quite serious. Depression, anxiety, dramatically higher suicide rates. Some argue if we don't take the affirmative approach, there's going to be high suicide, mm-hmm, rates. There actually already are. So that's part of the overall debate. I don't pretend to be an expert on it. So I'm simply articulating what's out there right now.
But we see this in other areas in culture today, where what would normally be something openly discussed by scientists and physicians, even things like abortion, the impact of that physically on patients' mental health and other things, there's a blanket of silence that's imposed for ideological reasons.
Right. And case I brought up was a BBC movie just aired called Transgender Kids, Who Gets to Decide? And what was interesting about it aired in January, and transgender activists tried to suppress the documentary from airing on the BBC. And some argued that it simply is not a mental health problem, and what they want is surgery or affirmation in what they see as their true identity, irrespective of their biological sex. And one leading therapist who recently was forced out of his position in Canada was not even opposed to surgery in extreme cases, but he wanted to start with an attempt at correcting the misalignment. He was forced out, and people basically disagreed with even an attempt to help somebody adapt to their biological sex with an alignment in gender.
This is a kind of fluid situation with the Trump administration. I think we'll watch and see what happens with Trump, but at the same time, right now, I would like to talk about Flannery O'Connor, because that's really what I've been itching to talk about this whole segment. You wrote a review of the new PBS documentary on the beloved Catholic writer Flannery O'Connor. This seems a kind of surprising choice for public television. Why does PBS hold up Flannery?
You know, it's interesting. I was taken aback. There are interviews with Bishop Emeritus Kenneth Kevin Bolin of Savannah, Holy Cross priests who are experts on this, as well as secular experts. But it was a reminder that the church holds her very dear. Mm-hmm. And part of the documentary, beyond just the fact that she is considered one of the great short story writers of the 20th century in the United States, and was bedridden for most of her life. She had lupus, was diagnosed with lupus in her 20s. Her father died of lupus. She was bedridden by the time she was 25, and so spent really among her most, well, probably her most productive years, basically in isolation, occasional trips out for lectures when she had the strength, under the care of her mother and physicians, far away in a farm mm-hmm. with peacocks roaming around. It's because she is considered one of the best short story writers in the United States that she is of interest. But she's also a very quirky person. She's
yes.
fun to quote. Her stories are kind of fascinating, and they turned kind of a religious sensibility on their head in their day.
Yes. Do you have a favorite Flannery story?
Well, I love, just to let you know, I'm actually doing a continuing education course right now at Stanford University on Flannery O'Connor and Faulkner.
Oh, nice.
William Faulkner. So they actually, the documentary mentions their relationship and his influence on her work, and perhaps vice versa. I don't know about that. But I love, there are a couple I like. One is A Good Man is Hard to Find.
Me too.
That's a good one. And in that one, I mentioned that in my piece, and it's mentioned in the documentary because it's one of the iconic stories. And this southern matriarch goes on what appears to be a predictable, rather tedious family road trip down to Florida from the south. And she decides they should stop and see some kind of, you know, old plantation home along the way. And her very poor sense of direction lands this rather ordinary, almost cartoonish family into an accident in a variety of complicated, funny, bizarre ways, only to hit, you know, to be in a head-on collision. I mean, spiritually and practically speaking, with the so-called misfit,
right.
A convict, an escaped convict, who now has the family in his sights. I don't want to spoil the end of the story, but what she tries to do in many of her stories is almost using violence and even lethal force mm-hmm. to clarify what's really at stake spiritually. And this confrontation with lethal force provokes a kind of epiphany where people go, okay, now I know what's really important.
Why is it important to celebrate great Catholic writers, especially Catholic fiction writers? I think of Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, others, especially in the 20th century. The importance of fiction in translating the faith into culture and bringing that Catholic imagination.
Well, I think culture goes under the radar. That's one reason. I think culture, faith-infused culture nourishes our faith. And, you know, there's a big debate that goes on in Catholic circles about how specifically Catholic this, you know, art needs to be, literature needs to be, representational art needs to be. I think it can be very religious and not religious at all. Flannery O'Connor chose to have very explicit themes expressed mm-hmm. in a variety of different ways. She used the word grace, faith, the Bible. And often she would kind of caricature self-important or self-righteous Christians who
right.
thought they really understood what was going on and they really didn't understand what was going on. But so I think it's delightful for that. And speaking back on Archbishop Gomez, he has supported the, you know, conferences on this subject. And a couple of years ago, I went to a conference on the Catholic literary imagination mm-hmm. in Los Angeles that was supported by the Archdiocese that also celebrated Flannery O'Connor, among other authors.
You know, this is really the kind of conversation that we love to have at the Register. Along with our news, you know, because these are the ways I think that we stay sane.
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if we watch the news all the time, if we wrote and read about the negative or kind of dark or tensions that are going on in our society all the time, I think we would shrivel up and die. You know, it's really these the elements of literature, the calls to holiness, like Archbishop Gomez, that point us to that which is true, beautiful, and good. And that's really what we are trying to do at the Register, mixed in with this daily output of news and the Catholic take on the current news of the day. So I am glad, Joan, that you keep abreast on things like this documentary, which is quite unique. I probably would have missed it if it weren't for you. And also the other arts that you bring to your blog, particularly. You often bring in some great artistic things into your blog.
Oh, I think it's great to include those. And let me just make a final point during Lent. Flannery O'Connor, really, with her physical health problems, really struggled. She had a long Lent herself.
Sure.
And she went to Lourdes, I point that out in the blog, but actually prayed more to be a better writer than to have her health improved.
Really? Yes. That's great. That's a beautiful way to end.
And it's nice to have priorities.
Absolutely. And really, because it was her writing that has really witnessed the Christian faith to many people. So that's a beautiful thing to pray for. It may not be the most obvious of our needs that we should be praying for.
It was her ministry.
It was. It was indeed. Well, thanks, Joan. Thanks a lot for being with us today. I'm so glad to see you in person.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the church and the major events of the day, remember to go to ncregister.com. For my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.